That's John chapter 21, verse 20 through 22. Then Peter turned around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved, following whom he had leaned on his breast at supper, and said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "But Lord, what about this man?" Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? Follow me."
Golf great Arnold Palmer recalled a lesson that he learned about overconfidence one time. He said it was the final hole of the 1961 Masters tournament, and he said, "I had a one-stroke lead, and I had just hit a very satisfying tee shot. I felt I was in a pretty good shape. As I approached my ball, I saw an old friend standing at the edge of the gallery. He motioned me over, stuck out his hand, and said, 'Congratulations.' So I shook his hand, but as soon as I did, I knew I had lost my focus. On my next two shots, I hit the ball into a sand trap, then put it over the edge of the green. I missed a putt and lost the Masters." He said, "You don't forget a mistake like that. You just learn from it and become determined that you will never do that again." In Mark chapter 14 and in Matthew chapter 26, Jesus addresses the disciples a few nights before his death and tells them that they're all going to leave him. He says, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night." And he quotes an Old Testament prophecy from Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7, where the prophet predicted, "I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." Jesus being the shepherd, the sheep being the disciples, would all be scattered. And then Jesus said, "But after I've been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." He tried to slip some hope in there. Peter wasn't one to be shy about his feelings. So he said, "Lord, all may be made to stumble, but I will never be made to stumble." Jesus then predicted to him, "Before this night is over, and before the rooster crows in the morning, you will have denied me three times." Peter confidently asserted, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." And then all the disciples chimed in likewise, Matthew and Mark remind us. In Luke chapter 22, a little bit more of the conversation is recorded. In verse 31, Jesus says, "Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you that he may sift you as wheat." Satan is going to tempt you. You're put in mind of the way that in the book of Job, there was a gathering of what is called the sons of God, and they came before to appear God, and Satan was there among them. There's a conversation that ensues wherein God allows Satan to tempt Job, but not to the point of his health. And then after Satan has tempted Job by taking away his sons and daughters and all of his livestock, there's another conversation that ensues where God says, "See, Job did not fall into temptation and curse and deny God." Satan then urged God on a little bit more and said, "Well, why don't you let me touch his body? Why don't you let me affect his health?" And God said, "Well, you can do that, but don't touch his life." And so then Job became ill with all the illnesses of which we know, all the sores that were on his body, and everything that happened to him during the course of those things. But he didn't curse God. He didn't rail against his Creator. He did not lash out at his Creator for allowing those things to happen to him. The idea that you get there is that Satan is on a leash and God will only let him go so far. And New Testament commentary on that idea is 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, that says God will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we're able to bear, but will allow a way of escape so that we may be able to bear what we're facing. Well, here Satan has desired to take Peter, Simon, Simon, and sift him as wheat. But Jesus said to Simon in Luke chapter 22, verse 31, "But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. But after you have returned, then strengthen your brethren." You'll return, he's predicting. You'll fall, you'll return, and then you'll have the job of strengthening your brethren. Well, once again, Peter confidently asserted, "Lord, I'll go to prison with you, I'll go to death with you, but I will not deny you." And then Jesus reasserted his statement that before the rooster would crow, he would deny him three times. Peter was a little bit confident about his allegiance to his Lord. You all recall the stories. We studied them not long ago. And you'll recall them from a lifetime of study, that there was, at Jesus' first trial, a parade from the Garden of Gethsemane to the first trial in Caiaphas' home. Not a parade, but a march of soldiers that came out to get Jesus. And Peter followed at a distance behind. He warmed himself at a coal of fires, John chapter 15, verse 18 said, with those who were surrounding the Jewish people, or those who were surrounding Caiaphas' household. He was warming himself at that coal of fires with the enemy. And then a servant girl came up to him and said, "You were with Jesus of Galilee, weren't you?" He said, No, I was not. That servant girl then told some others who stood by, according to Matthew's account in Matthew 29, verses 69 through 75. And according to Mark's account, and another came up and said to Jesus, "You were with him, weren't you?" Or said to Peter, "You were with Jesus of Nazareth, weren't you?" And he denied it again and said that he was not. And then according to Matthew and Mark, those who stood by asked him again. According to John, one of those other fellows who was there, who was a relative of the one whose ear Peter had cut off in the Garden of Gethsemane, said to Peter, "You were with Jesus of Nazareth, weren't you?" And he began to curse and swear and call down oaths and said, "I am not with him." At which point, Luke records, Jesus' eyes turned from across the courtyard and caught Peter's eyes, staring him dead in the face at the moment of his denial, right as the rooster crowed. Peter had fallen from his great confidence. He was overconfident in what he felt like he could do in allegiance to his Lord, and then he fell. What we come across here in John chapter 21 is Peter being restored to a position after Jesus' resurrection. I don't know how you could imagine the depth of despair that Peter had felt unless you'd had an undying allegiance to the Lord, but then found yourself denying him. Maybe if some of us have been there in some sort of situation, but probably not to the degree that Peter has, at least not among this crowd of people. He wept bitterly on that occasion, Matthew records. And then he's one of the first to run to the tomb when he hears of Jesus' resurrection. John and Peter hear of it together, and John outruns Peter to get to the tomb, but Peter's the first one to go into the tomb. Now, can you imagine the mix of emotions that he must have had on that occasion? When he comes out of that tomb, who knows what he's thinking? Over the next 40 days, there are several appearances. It seems that Jesus appeared to Simon on that very first day that he was resurrected because of Luke chapter 24, verse 34. After Jesus had been talking with two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they learned that Jesus had been talking with them, they go report to the rest of the disciples, "The Lord is risen indeed and has appeared to Simon." When exactly that took place, we don't know, but apparently that meeting of the two disciples and Jesus was on that first day that he was resurrected, because Luke says it was the very same day. And then after that, they say that he's already appeared to Simon, so he'd appeared to him at some point. And then there have been other appearances. There were the 10 on the same day. There were 11 a week later. There were 500 at once. There were all those appearances. And Peter might be getting the idea that something unique is going on here. And he might be getting the idea that he might have to reckon for his sins of denying the Lord. In John chapter 21, Peter says, "I'm going fishing." And there are six other disciples that join him. While they're out on the boat, after a night's worth of work that has yielded no fish, they see an apparition on the seashore that is not an apparition in reality, but is a body. And it's an animated body. It's the real, raised, spiritual body of Jesus, but they don't know that yet. When Jesus says, "Cast the nets on the other side of the boat and see if you can catch anything there." And that, of course, would hearken to the way that Peter, Andrew, James, and John were called in Luke chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, when Jesus said the same sort of thing, and they came up with a great sort of catch. They'll come up with a great catch here, and then they figure out this is Jesus, and Peter throws on his outer garment and jumps in the sea and swims to Jesus. He's impetuous. The other disciples come on a little boat that's let down, a skiff that is let down from the main fishing boat in which they are. But Peter gets there first. And then there is, interestingly and almost poetically, a coal fire that is there, just like there was when Peter denied the Lord. So Jesus gathers around that coal fire with Peter and has a little bit of a discussion with him. I think you remember how the discussion goes. In John chapter 21, verse 15, "So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these? Do you love me?" He gives him the chance to confess his love for him again. Now, Jesus hadn't asked him to confess that before, but that's what Peter had done. Jesus had said, "All of you are going to leave me." But Simon stood up and said, No, I'm never leaving you. I'll die with you before I leave you." And Jesus said, "No, you'll leave me before the rooster crows." Well, now Jesus comes from the positive angle. He asks, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" His first question to him has a comparison involved. Do you love me more than these? Now, it's hard to tell exactly from the Greek what exactly he means. Commentators are divided over this, but most commentators that I've read say it's hard to tell what he means by that. Do you love me more than these fish? That's been the last thing in the discussion. They'd caught 153 fish. You wonder if Jesus is gesturing to the fish and asking Simon Peter, "Do you love me more than your job of fishing to which you have appeared to be going back?" Or Jesus could have been gesturing to the disciples and asking, "Do you love me more than these disciples?" In that case, he might have been saying, "Do you love me more than you love these disciples?" And then also he could have been asking this, "Do you love me more than these disciples love me?" That's a possibility in the language as well. Maybe Jesus meant for it to be open-ended. Maybe he meant for it to be ambiguous, just to see how much love Peter would confess on this occasion. It is interesting to us to note, and important that we note, that the word love here in the Greek is that agape word that was mentioned in class a little bit ago, and we've discussed so much. It is the word that is often used for unconditional love. It's a word that's used for a deciding love. That is, I'm going to decide to love you almost sometimes, whether I like you or not. I'm going to decide to do what's best for you. It's the word that Jesus used when he said, "Love your enemies," in Matthew chapter 5. So he's asking Simon, "Are you going to decide to love me? Are you going to choose to love me? Are you going to follow me? Are you going to do the things that I want you to do?" It's the word that Jesus used when he said, "If you love me, keep my commandments," in John 14, verse 15. It is the word that Jesus used in John 14, verse 23, when he says, "If anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and we will come to him, and my Father and I will make our home with him." Jesus is asking, "Do you make a decision to love me?" And Simon is a little more humble about it this time than he was last time. What he says to Jesus is, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." But in the Greek, the word is the word phileo, which means a brotherly love. Generally speaking, it's a kind of affectionate love. It's a kind of feeling sort of love. Some people have argued that it's a lesser type of love. Some people argue it's just a different kind of love, whereas agape is deciding you're going to love someone. Phileo is when you really feel that you love someone. Oftentimes you might decide that you love someone even if you don't like them at first, but then after you do for them and treat them well as you're supposed to treat them, then a feeling comes along and you might even form a friendship. It's hard to tell exactly, some people say, what Peter is trying to say when he uses a different word of love. Some people might say it's just stylistic. I didn't want to use the same exact word for it. You know, in English we have that word, love, and it could mean agape love, it could mean brotherly love, it could mean sexual love, it could mean I love pizza, it could mean something frivolous like that. It could mean all kinds of different things, but the Greeks had seven words or so for it, and maybe it's just a stylistic thing. I tend to think that maybe Peter is trying to be a little bit more humble here than he was the first time around. "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me with that agape love wherein you will keep my commandments? Do you love me with that deciding love? Do you love me with the love of the mind where your will and volition will decide to love me and show it in the things that you do?" And Peter's just a little bit more humble than that. Instead of saying, "I'll live up to that this time," he says, "You know, I have strong feelings for you. You are my brother. You are a human being. You've been my leader the last 3 years. I've been following you. You've done so much for me. I've got all kinds of strong feelings, but maybe," he's saying, just maybe he's saying, "I'm just not sure I can quite live up to claiming that agape love yet." So Jesus then says to him, "Feed my lambs. Feed my lambs." Jesus calls his people sheep, as you know, and elders are often regarded as shepherds, and 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 25, as we read a little bit ago, calls him the bishop and overseer of our souls. And 1 Peter 5 calls him the great shepherd of the sheep and likens elders to shepherds. And you know all the analogies. And Jesus says in John chapter 10, I am the good shepherd. Well, remember that Jesus had said to Peter, back when he said, Satan has desired to sift you as wheat, that after you are restored, after you return to me, strengthen your brethren. You're going to have a job to do after you return to me. So Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Well, yes, Lord, I feel for you. Well, you need to go do your job. You need to go feed my lambs. The second time, Jesus asked him in verse 16, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Do you love me? Again, with the agape love, do you love me? And Jesus was answered, Simon said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Just like previously, he used the word phileo. This time, Jesus responds to him, tend my sheep. That's the Greek word poimano, where we get the idea of shepherding, of pastoring. The elders pastor a congregation of sheep, pastor a congregation of people. So, tend my sheep. And then the third time, Jesus says to him in verse 17, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Jesus uses the word phileo at that time. Jesus doesn't use the word agape the third time. He said, Simon, son of Jonah, first time, do you love me with that unconditional mind-deciding love? Well, you know, Lord, I feel for you. Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me with that unconditional mind-deciding kind of love? Well, you know, I love you with a brotherly love. And then the third time, it's almost as if he leans in to ask, do you really love me with that brotherly love? And the reason I think that's the nuance that's given to it is because of what comes next. Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And beyond that, we don't have any explanation. Peter was grieved to him because he said the third time, do you phileo me? Beyond that, there's no other reason given. We might wonder what's all behind that grief. Is there the grief of realization that this is the third time that he's confessing his love for Christ, whereas prior to that he had three denials of Christ? Is it a grief because Jesus seems to have lowered the expectation and asked, do you really love me on that level? We just don't know for sure. But he was grieved because he has to go through this conversation and because Jesus asked the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know what's in my heart. We learned that at the beginning of the Gospel of John. Jesus knew what was in people's hearts. Peter acknowledges it here. He's being a little bit more humble than he was when he said, if I have to die with you, I won't deny you. He's humbled himself in the sight of the Lord. And guess what? The Lord is going to lift him up. Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And he said to him that third time, if you love me, feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. Tend my sheep. Feed my sheep. There's a lot that is in those ideas, but there's one thing that is not in those ideas. Some people get from this passage and some other passages that Jesus was one who was pointing out that Peter ought to be the first disciple, the first apostle, the one above the others, the one that had the responsibility of being above the others in some sort of hierarchy, and indeed the predecessor of what they now regard as the first pope. That's not involved in this at all. Matter of fact, all the disciples would be charged to teach in all the world all things that Jesus had commanded him. They would all have that equal charge. The reason that Peter is set aside here, for reasons that we can only speculate beyond what the Holy Spirit has revealed, the reason that Peter is set aside is because he's the one who denied him three times, it would seem to me, and because he's the one who has the chance to then confess him three times, and then as an illustration for all of us, and then thirdly, as a way to lead to the very climax of the book, or the end of the book anyway, at the end of chapter 21. So here's what happens after all of that. Peter's supposed to be the one who's going to open the doors to the kingdom of heaven in Matthew 16, verses 18 and 19. Peter would be the one, indeed, who would be rock solid when he comes out of the resurrection appearances and preaches on the day of Pentecost. He would be the one who preaches on the day of Pentecost and tells those throngs of people, you called for the crucifixion of the one who's now resurrected and sits at the right hand of God. He would be the one that would defy the councils and the authorities and say, we need to listen to God rather than listen to you when you tell us to stop preaching about the resurrection. We can only speak those things which we have seen and heard. He would be the one that history tells us would go to his crucifixion while defending the resurrection of Christ. Now here's what Jesus says next to him in John chapter 21. Most assuredly I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and you walked about where you wished. You did what you wanted to when you were younger, Peter. You were just a wild sort of man. We might interpolate a little bit. We don't know everything about that. But you made your own decisions. You did what you wanted to do. You went where you wanted to go. But when you are older, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. If he had left out that phrase, you will stretch out your hands, we could be content with the idea that whereas Peter in his former life did what he wanted to do, in the last part of his life, he would be doing what Jesus wanted him to do. Another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish. Another will cause you to make your decisions and do your things on behalf of him. But when Jesus says, stretch out your hands, he is, according to verse 19, signifying by what kind of death Peter would die. He would die stretching out his hands. Not a lot of people that I know in the hospitals that I've seen die stretch out their hands. They're usually folded up to themselves, and they're usually taking their last breaths. Even in violent deaths, there might be people who stretch out their hands. And maybe those violent deaths aren't necessarily crucifixions. But you don't usually, that's the point, you don't usually think of a peaceful death with someone stretching out his hands for some kind of relief. He could stretch out his hands for some kind of relief in a violent death, or he could stretch out his hands on a cross in a violent death. History tells us that would happen, but here's the significance in John chapter 21. Jesus is telling Peter, look, if you want to say that you love me, okay, that's good. I want you to feed my lambs. I want you to tend my sheep. I want you to do all of that. But realize it's going to cost you. It's going to cost you some suffering. You're going to have to die for this. You're going to have to take up your cross and bear it quite literally. Now, Jesus promises all of us that if we're not willing to take up our cross and bear it, not willing to lose our lives for his sake, then we're not really going to be followers of his. If it be a literal cross, then that need be. But if it not be, then there's some sort of figurative meaning to that cross that simply says there's a point in our lives where we stop doing what we want to do and we let another carry us about, and that is Jesus, and we do what he wants us to do. Well, Peter knew that he was going to die now. And Jesus said to him, follow me. Jesus never promised a whole bunch of nice things. That separates him from a lot of televangelists today who say that if you send in your money, you'll have health and wealth, your people will get well, your family will get well, and all these things that you do. Jesus never promised all those sorts of things. He never gained anyone by deceit. He always spelled out what was involved or what could be involved if people followed him. Now to Peter specifically, more so than he is to you and me, to Peter specifically, he says, you follow me, you're going to have a death to die that's going to be because of me. But follow me and tend my lambs and feed my sheep. Now Peter wonders about what he should do. Peter wonders about what should go on. He probably has all sorts of things running through his mind about how that could be distasteful, that could be painful. Into what am I getting myself? If I were there, there'd be a whole slew of scenarios running through my head, and I'd be trying to figure them all out. And I wouldn't blame Peter at all if that were the case. We know that one thought crossed his mind because of what happens in verse 20 and following. Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, that phrase has come up a few times in the book of John. Here's the disciple whom Jesus loved. He was the one that leaned on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper and said, "Who is it that's going to betray you?" That comes up here in a minute in John chapter 21. Most people have thought that it's the writer of this letter using the third person to describe himself. We know it's the writer of this letter because in verse 24, he says, "This is the disciple who testifies of these things and wrote these things." And we know that his testimony is true. And so, since traditionally the book has been ascribed to John the Apostle, we believe that that disciple whom Jesus loved is John. The disciple whom Jesus loved is standing behind Peter. Peter turns around and sees him, and he says to him, "What about this man?" You know what he's asking? Is he going to have to die for you? Is he going to have to go to a cross for you? Is he going to have to suffer in any way for you? Now, fast forward in history, and John would be the only apostle that did not die a martyr's death. Although he was persecuted greatly for his faith in Christ, he did not die a martyr's death. Peter wonders, when he's told what's going to happen to him, what's going to happen to this guy? And Jesus says, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." So John says then a rumor went out that some people said John was going to live till Jesus came again. And no, that wasn't the case that John records here. No, that wasn't what happened at all. Jesus only said, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." And hopefully we see the lesson. Christianity is a collective thing in that we're here as brothers and sisters in Christ to try and encourage each other and help each other. We meet together on the first day of the week and every other time that the elders decide is good for us because, well, we want the strength that comes from being together. First, we want to simply obey the Lord and not forsake the assembly. But those people who are really reaching out to try and be everything that they can be and humbly love their Lord are the kind of people that get together with Christians every time they have the chance. Sunday morning Bible class, Wednesday night Bible class, gospel meetings. Even go to gospel meetings at other congregations. Meet with Christians and have dinner with them. They'll do everything that they can to encourage one another and strengthen one another. That's the idea of the church, at least in part. But Christianity is also a very personal thing. It's not so personal that you can take it so far and say, "Well, I worship God out in the woods when I'm out there hunting, and therefore I don't need to be a part of the church." No, no, that's just sinful. That's just wrong. But it is personal in this regard. There might be things that happen to me that won't happen to other people, and it's not my job to ask God, "Why didn't you do that to them?" It's not my job to say, "What about the cross that this man has to bear?" It's not my job to say, "Why do I have it harder than anybody else around me?" Nor is it my job to say, "Why do I have it easier than anybody else around me?" Although you very rarely hear people asking that sort of question. People will say, "Why me?" But they won't say, "Why not me?" Could happen to anybody. Why not me? So Peter is asking, "If I'm going to die, what about this man?" And Jesus' reply resounds throughout the ages. It's not about the person next to you, what he does. It's not about your peers at school. It's not about the people at work, and it's not about the people across from you, even in the aisle. It's about you and what you do in service to Christ. So while Galatians chapter 6, verse 1 and 2 tells us that we ought to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ, verse 5 reminds us that in the final analysis, in the last sense, each one shall bear his own load. There have been people that don't come to religious services, don't come to church services, because they say, "Well, there are hypocrites in that church." Well, what's that have to do with you? You follow me. What's that have to do with my allegiance to the Lord? What's that have to do with me holding back from following him? Nothing. Nothing at all. It's very personal, and it's a responsibility. Story is told that in this hospital at the Kenistone Regional Healthcare System in the state of Georgia, there was a patient that accidentally knocked over a cup of water. Now, the hospital policy said that nurses' aides were responsible for small spills, and housekeeping department was responsible for large spills. Nurse's aide said, well, that's a large spill. I don't need to clean that up. Housekeeping said, no, that's too small for us. We're not going to clean that up. So they argued back and forth for a while. Nurse's aide repeating her claim, that's a large spill. House cleaning needs to clean that up. And housekeeping repeating their claim, no, that's a small spill. Nurse's aide needs to clean that up. When finally the patient took a pitcher of water and poured it on the floor and asked, is that a big enough puddle for you to decide now? There's no deciding about whose responsibility Christianity is. Someone strays from the fold. Is that just the elder's responsibility? No, it's everyone's, according to Galatians 6, verse 1. Someone does the work to keep the church house going. Is that delegated to someone? Sure, but could he use some help? Yeah. Is there some need to teach the gospel of Christ? Well, that's the preacher's job. Well, it's the preacher's job, and it's everybody's job. It's everybody's responsibility, and we're here to help each other work together like that. It's my responsibility to do what I need to do in order to be saved from a devil's hell. I can't put that on my parents. As godly as they were, their righteousness will not get me into heaven. I have to decide myself to follow him. If I had godly grandparents before that, or I had a godly wife, or I had godly children, it doesn't matter in the final judgment when I will stand before the judgment seat of Christ. He won't ask how my family was in the church. He won't ask how many times I came to church. He'll ask, what did you do? What did you do? And I'll say, well, I did more than that person, and I did more. No. What did you do? And I'll have to answer for whether or not I served him the very best that I could. Because he knows. Lord, you know. If you've never been baptized into Christ, please consider that carefully. It's your responsibility. Your family won't get you to heaven. Would you confess your faith in Christ and be baptized into him today? If you haven't been living up to responsibilities, then change and be restored the way Peter was restored as an example for the kinds of things that can happen to all of us if we come back to the Lord in penitence and humility. And if we could help you this morning, please come as we stand and sing. Make